in speaking of the five ranks, it's important to be clear that there are two different aspects when we talk about this interrelationship of relative and absolute differences and equality. There's the intrinsic aspect, and there's the experiential. And it's important to see our practice and our life in both these aspects. And if I use the word experience, the intrinsic as our own, which is what the experiential is. So though we might hear words, even believe words, whether we read it in the sutras and dharma literature of all sorts, if we just know that it's that way, intrinsically it's so, and yet it's not so for us, then it remains inadequate. That's just, though everyone you meet is only Buddha, though you can say those words and even agree to that, experientially it's not so for you. And if it's not so experientially, then it really doesn't penetrate your life, your functioning, your manifesting it. So we often talk about aspects of practice from the intrinsic side and then from the experiential side. And in a way, we can see many of ancestors for whom this need to make the intrinsic their own experience is really what drove them. So this first rank that we talked about, the rank, or you could say first position rank, has another word in English, another meaning in English, which is negative, as opposed to saying it the first gradation or the first position. The first position is the one where the phenomenal is seen, in other words, all relative circumstances, all differences are seen within their absolute equality. And this is very difficult for us, the universal aspect of them, the absolute. If again I say it's not quite the same, but if I say it's the form is empty, the empty side, which we tend to miss. Empty meaning able to manifest freely in all ways. Meaning, if everything is one single vastness, I won't even say anything more, it lacks, doesn't hold on to, and doesn't stick to any particular relative position, any particular differences. This is a great deal for us because most of the time in our life we stick to particulars and we get in trouble with particulars. Particulars meaning our reactions and beliefs and likes and dislikes of particulars. See, it's not the particulars, but it's us sticking to them that gets us into trouble. So in one sense, this rank is clearly grasping the genuine absolute identity, if I say such a word. Yet, it's still not quite enough, because we bump into things. Despite the fact that we can say such things, despite the fact that we even have this experience when circumstances occur. Circumstances meaning differences of all sorts, conditions of all sorts arise. We bump into it. Bumping into it means we get into trouble, we get upset about it, we don't like it, we do like it, we want it a certain way, we react. So despite having not only this intrinsic ability, or this intrinsic, I should say, that's the wrong word, this intrinsic comprehension, and having gone beyond that with an experiential sense in our own life of the, again I'll use that fancy word, absolute equality, the universal oneness, if I use that kind of word, or emptiness, still we stick to things. Despite the fact that it's intrinsically so, we see our experience, call it our reactive habits, call it whatever. So the next rank is called the absolute within the relative. If you want to use the analogy, again, it's just analogy. It's in the Heart Sutra. Emptiness is form. That's where we see that everything we encounter is manifesting this universal absolute that we are, that we share. This is what's sometimes called jeweled mirror understanding, jeweled mirror samadhi. This is that everything we meet is our own original face that we're encountering. Everything and everyone. See? Then we're seeing the universal in the relative, in the differences. See, so this is a step further in our practice, in our understanding, in our experience of our own life. And it's a step that enables us, in a way you could say, to not only realize emptiness, if that's the first to some degree or other, but to actualize it. See, when you hear Dogen talking about when the self goes forth and realizes the 10,000 things is delusion, then the 10,000 things, meaning all phenomena, realize self, manifest self, actualize self. That's awakening. That's this level that Dogen's talking about. See? So, mind, body, fallen away. Hakuin cites Dogen for this, which is very interesting, since Hakuin at that time, let's say, I'll guess it was 1750, Common Era. Might have been a few years earlier, a few years later. But it was that period when Dogen was still treated as his writings were a secret, understandings, and there were just bits and pieces in the various Soto lineages and teaching schools, but they didn't really have the public awareness of the full body of his writings. Many of his fascicles were kept, or copies of them were kept, in individual temples and monasteries. Anyway, Hakuin had come into some contact with it, and actually much appreciated Dogen, which is very interesting, given his criticism of many others, meaning many other contemporaries who he felt were practicing a know-nothing Zen, or a Zen where they only sat but really didn't emphasize and appreciate awakening and bodhisattva activity. So Hakuin says this is the second level, this jeweled mirror samadhi of the absolute in the relative, is what Dogen is talking about when he says mind, body, fallen away, mind, body. Shinjin Datsuraku, Datsuraku Shinjin is the Japanese where Dogen describes his awakening. So this is when Hakuin talks about this mirror samadhi, this ability for us to see in all things our true face, which is the true face of awakening, the experience that we have of our own what our life is, and then in all other beings, seeing that's nothing but ourself. That this is Hakuin cites, it's like snow piled up in a silver bowl, or it's like two mirrors that reflect each other. This is an important step for us, but we don't have to treat it in terms of steps. When we see others, do we think they're other than our own true nature? They're other than, if I use the word, Buddha nature? When we hear others, do we believe that they're other than? Well, right there is where we're getting in trouble. Right there is the source, S-O-U-R-C-E, source of our difficulties. Okay. Okay, and that's the important part. This is our practice of manifesting what happens on our cushion, what happens in our life, manifesting it when we see others, when we do things. If we see things outside, so to speak, as being outside ourselves, then we know we're not clear. We know we're caught up. And yet it's not about some just conceptual, but this has to be our deep understanding out of our experience and living and manifesting. Being able to take care of what's called for, whatever there is to do, doing it. See, because it's exactly our life. If we hesitate, then we know we're stuck somewhere. See, this is what it is. This is our point. This is what the Buddha says in all the various sutras, and you read it. But when you read it and it's just something you've read and even can repeat it, but it's not so when you encounter it, then you know there's work to be done. See, if you still believe there are dusts, so to speak, in the world, there are things that are lacking, then you're not doing completely whatever there is to be done. See, that's why in our sitting practice here, in our sesshin practice, in our day-to-day life practice, that's where we get to actualize this, not because we figured it out, but because in our doing it, we manifest what's so. Manifesting what's so, we get to experience. And in a way, that's a bridge, if I say, a link between this so-called intrinsic and so-called experiential. Because if we take the intrinsic as our guide, despite our hesitancy, despite our bumping into it, despite our saying, I don't agree with it, it makes no sense, like, if we take it as our guide for functioning, that's what practice is about, taking that as our guide for functioning, then we experience our life at some point in the functioning as our life truly is. In a way, that's what training and practice are all about. And that's why our training is the way it is. In one sense, if I say it this way, we make ourselves be the absolute or the universal or the equality. Make ourselves be that by doing it. It isn't what makes us so. What makes us so is that it is so. And yet, unless we make ourselves so, despite the fact that it is so, it is not so for us. See? And we make ourselves be the absolute. That means making the phenomenal world in all the various senses, all the so-called relative differences, work, our life, all relationships, whether externals or internals, so to speak, all of those are our practice opportunities. That's what the point of talking about this is, not to talk about some esoteric ancient thing from China or Japan, whether it's 1,000 years ago or 300, 400, 500 years ago. That's not the point of me talking about this. Though I enjoy that, it's of no use for you. See? When we use the various words, it's to enable us to clarify. See, though I use words like phenomenal or relative to describe the various so-called particularities, it's always those particularities as being nothing but the embodiment of this true nature that we are. See? Now, even though this might sound like a great attainment, What we have to know is this is only the second. If we get stuck here, if one were to get stuck here, then that's still trouble. Even if it's a state of oneness with our environment, our self, our circumstances, even if it's, we use a fancy word, oneness, non-duality, not two, this is still just a level where we need to continue practice from, because if we get stuck there, then we're in trouble, because we don't allow the manifesting of this bodhisattva nature that we are. We don't allow and take care of causal conditions, cause and effect. We could use the word karma to make and support the practice of all that we encounter, which is only ourself. That yesterday I didn't give enough time for us to discuss and clarify this together. So I will stop at this point, especially since I need to be careful that I don't say too much. As I said yesterday, if I say too much, then it just feeds our empty ideas as opposed to encouraging our practice together, your practice, my practice, because it's always a matter of what I say here as an encouragement, whether because you don't get it or you see where there's effort needed, so that we, each of us, over and over, further deepen our understanding through our own life practice. Not to give us words and ideas, but enable us to see what needs to be done. Okay, so I will stop now, and if we can explore this a little together, hopefully that will be useful. And if I've confused you, good, bring up your confusion. Confusion's an always a good driver of our practice effort. If we can make the confusion a useful confusion, then we can do something with it.
Does that mean that confusion should be an encouraging them?
Sure. Don't I always say to you, when you're confused, don't we talk about how to practice with confusion?
Oh, I think I missed that.
Who's confused? Look, take the confusion energy. Hakuing talks about it as great doubt. Great doubt is confusion. Take that great doubt. You need great doubt, great determination, and great faith, or the great effort if you want. Great confusion is wonderful. Take that, grab a hold of it, and turn that energy. Don't believe the confusion. Don't live out the confusion. Don't act out the confusion, but take it. Because right there you see there's something vital and alive. If you don't care and don't make effort, then confusion really wouldn't be a big deal to you. You're only confused when you really are struggling with something. It's like if you're lifting weights, confusion is like a heavy weight that you can barely do something with, but you can do it, but you have to make the effort. if you just go, oh, this is too heavy, okay, I won't bother with that, then we don't do the work with the muscle that's required, which is almost, in a sense, tearing the muscle in the appropriate way. Tearing muscles a little bit, that's how you strengthen muscles. If some of you may know more physiology than I do, but literally, when you're lifting weights or making any kind of exercise, you're making an effort that forces your muscles to go beyond their current ability, which to a certain extent tears them in micro ways. I don't mean doing what you can't do, what's beyond your capacity, but going at the limits of your capacity. In the same way, confusion means you've got your teeth sunk into something and you're really struggling with it. Good.
Doesn't feel good.
Where does feel good have to do with it? When you try to lift a heavy weight, does it feel good when you have to make an effort to do it? When you have a problem and you have to figure out, how am I going to resolve this problem, whether it's, you know, with some woodwork you're doing or something else, when you confront the problem, if you say, oh, this doesn't feel good, I have to figure out, I don't know what to do here, and I've got to, you know, if you say, oh, well, I'm confused about it, I don't want to have to try to figure out something, it's new, something I haven't done before, it isn't the way it usually goes, then you don't learn anything new. You don't develop any new skills. In one sense here, practice is about learning, but not so much learning as going beyond what you already know. So in a sense, it's unlearning the limits of what you already think you know and are. See, that's why we start with, you know, the relative in the absolute, or the relative in the universal, or in the equality, which is what we talked about yesterday and a little bit today. Because we so much are sure that the relative, the differences are what matters. I am so and so, he is such and such, and ever it shall be so. And we so much believe that. This is this way, and this is that way. Remember, yesterday when I used the analogy of the numerator and denominator, we are constantly insisting on the top number. 1 and 5 are different numbers. But as soon as we add, oh, we have a mathematician here, I have to be careful, I'm in trouble with that. I'm just using this as an analogy, but as soon as we add a denominator of 0 under both of them, then their differences aren't quite the only thing about them. Now, mathematically, in higher math, this isn't quite so simple as my analogy, so please excuse me. But that's the point, is to see the 0 under each of them. The absolute equality, or the absolute universality, or the emptiness. Any of those words. But remember, those are just words. Don't grab on to the concepts that you have of them, because then all you have is the intrinsic, which isn't so for you. See, we have to make that alive for ourselves in our practice. Then we get to experientially be able to say, ah, that's what that's about. Because we know it for ourselves. That's what it's about, because we drank the cup of tea and know for ourselves the wetness of the tea. Not because someone else has told us that's wet and we've never seen or experienced wet before. Say, oh yeah, that's wet, but we don't really know what wet is. See? That's what this is about. Then it's taking this step further and seeing the wet in all the water that we encounter, and that's all we encounter. See? Is seeing that the 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 are all equally have a zero underneath them. A zero which changes them, so despite their oneness, they also have a certain, if I say, commonality.
Besides their oneness, they have a...
Besides the being one or two or three or four, excuse me.
Their individuality.
Yes. It's really not besides. That's, I said it that way, but it's not true that way. It's... That's the second, that's what the second rank clarifies. It's really, from the beginning, it's the the universal, the absolute in the relative. It's nothing but encountering your own face. It's two mirrors that reflect each other perfectly. See, that's... But those are just analogies. See? Those are just analogies. See? That's why we have the second rank called the universal within the phenomenal. The henchu sho, to use the Japanese phrase. The absolute within the relative. The emptiness is form, to use the analogous term in the Heart Sutra. See, the first step is form is emptiness. The second is emptiness is form. Form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness exactly, exactly form. Exactly. If we try to keep it on the level of language, language in a sense defeats us, because language inherently is dualistic. The dualism is what gets us in trouble. Not for any bad reason, but just because the very nature of dualistic languages and thinking, if that's the limits of how we function, then it's missing reality. Reality meaning what's so. Instead, the whole reality is being forced into the dualism. And if reality is forced into dualism, then it seems to us that it's dualistic. If our life is forced into dualism, then we perceive and experience our life in dualistic ways, despite the fact that that's not so. That's not the nature of our life. But it is so if you insist on it being so. See? For many years, medical doctors insisted, well, I shouldn't say insisted, but operated as if there was nothing on a microscopic level that they couldn't see that could create problems. Therefore, they didn't wash their hands because, you know, they couldn't carry germs from one thing to another. They didn't do other precautions, which we take now for granted, but they thought there's no point in that. There was a period in the 19th century where I heard about this. I had known about this for a while, but I heard someone on radio talking about this again, where in Vienna a physician, his name was Semmelweis, Ignaz Semmelweis, noticed that women who are giving birth in the hospital, there seem to be two cohorts, two groups, in terms of the survival rates of the mothers and children. One group were those who were being birthed sort of by the doctors and the medical students. The other group was those that were being birthed by midwives. And for some reason, those being birthed by doctors and medical students had much worse survival rates. No one could understand why. They looked at, you know, obviously the midwives had less training than these great doctors and medical students, etc., etc. They couldn't see anything. This guy postulated that it must be something that the doctors and medical students are doing different than the midwives. And what he discovered is that the doctors and medical students would come from autopsies and working with dead bodies and other diseased people directly into the birthing rooms and assisting the women in birth. So that he said there must be something that they're carrying on them in their hands, things you can't see or whatever, that's causing this. And the midwives weren't doing this. I don't know if there was the midwives were also cleaning their hands or not, but he attempted to get the doctors to clean their hands after they did autopsies and after they dealt with other necrotic material. And there was great resistance. But in some places where there wasn't, the survival rate for mothers and children changed. Now, we can say, oh yeah, we understand why that is. They were, you know, had infections on their hands, they had microbes, disease, bacteria, etc. But they didn't have that understanding. So something magical would seem to be happening. When we believe that the limits of our understanding are the way it is, then we get trapped by it. If they had great resistance and he was finally pushed out of the medical profession, and it wasn't until many years later that the discovery and understanding of bacteria and infection led to better sanitary conditions and cleaning one's hands after you did autopsy so that you didn't infect your next patient. The reason I bring this up is because if we believe the limits of our current understanding, which means, and current doesn't have to do with these days, but current meaning most dualistic functioning and languages and thinking, then we're guaranteed that we're going to be missing what our life is, because our life is going to be enclosed by that dualism. Self-centeredness, if I say it a different way. Our life is enclosed by self-centeredness because self and other seems like the natural truth of reality. Birth and death is the natural truth of who we are. We were born on such and such time, we're alive, and we die, and yet we're separate from the rest of the world, so on and so forth. That kind of thinking is fine. It works in some ways, but it doesn't work in a lot of other ways, and it gives rise to difficulties, suffering, harm, and as you just said, confusion. So, confusion is your practice friend. The greater the confusion, the greater the awakening, says Hakuin. Others say it too. Dogen talks about it too. Dogen was confused about just this matter. That's why he went to China, risking his life going to China. Because all these teachers say all beings are Buddha nature, have Buddha nature. Yet, why do we need to practice so? Why are things so unclear? That's what Dogen's, I'm encapsulating and simplifying, but that's what Dogen's, instigating and pushing drive was from. From that question. He needed to resolve that question for himself. That's what leads to body, mind falling away, body, mind of Dogen. So your confusion is good. Be confused. Struggle with it. Practice with it. I encourage you, make good use of it. Don't treat it as a problem. Don't treat it as bad. Don't treat it as anything but a friend.
An opportunity.
Make the opportunity be your support.
Well, another thought that came to me was that in relative terms, you know, in the relative, you know, the dualistic world, you know, I'm always...
Not the dualistic world, but the dualistic way of seeing the world.
Yeah, well, I'm always outside and looking, you know, at this dualistic stuff. Mm-hmm. But then the other way, this universal way, there is no outside to it.
Good.
But there's no inside.
Good.
But then how do you look at it?
Good. That's a good good point. No. Just how do you, what is it to experience without outside and inside? That's exactly what he says. Here, I'll quote you Dogen, not Dogen, this is Hakuin. He talks about when seeing the phenomenal within the universal, or the relative within the absolute. Above there is not a tile to cover head, below is not an inch of ground to stand on, there's neither delusive passions nor enlightenment, neither samsara nor nirvana. Everything is a single solid mass of emptiness, lacking any sort of odor. It is boundless, without even a trace of cloud, a clear pool that has no bottom. That's what Hakuin describes it as.
And those are just words to me.
Good! You're right. Those are just words. Don't be satisfied with them. You have to chew on it for yourself till you see what this is for yourself, not what someone else says. Someone else's isn't adequate for you. You're right. You have to experience this for yourself. Not because you have to go looking for this experience, but that in ongoing deepening of practice, this will occur of itself. Because what will occur is not something extra, but it's discovering what all along is so. See, that's what our practice is. To experience our life as it is. Not to go get something else or create something new. When we're not blinded by self-centeredness, when we're not blinded by our reactiveness, then, hey, then we get to be and see who and what our life is all the time. Has always been. See? That's... Someone quotes the Nirvana Sutra, which says the Buddha sees Buddha nature with his own eyes. With her own eyes. With our own eyes. We see, experience our own life with our own life. See, everything we meet is just our own face. See, doesn't matter whether you, in a way, that's really the description of the second rank, the absolute within the relative. But it doesn't make a difference. It's awakening. Sometimes for rank one, sometimes rank two. Don't worry about that. Because it's always experiential that's most valuable. Nevertheless, important to hear intrinsic, important to even grasp and have faith in it, but still need to struggle with it, so despite the faith, not enough. That's why practice. If you can practice in great faith and jump into the flow of that and there is no doubt, fine. I guarantee you, you'll encounter all sorts of circumstances. If you bump into something and you have problems with it, you know there's something there. if someone drives down the road and you start having upsets about how they're driving, you know there's something there. Unless, of course, they're going to hit you or someone else. That's something else. Then pull over to the side and call 911 or whatever the number to call is to get the police there before something happens. Okay?
Well, one more question.
Good.
What about manifesting? I'm trying to, you know, see that, but I don't see what manifesting. I don't understand that at all. I mean, I don't know.
You don't know what the word means, or?
I thought I did, but then when you say it, I don't know.
If someone speaks Italian, if you tell me you speak Italian, and then someone says something to you in Italian and you respond to them in Italian, that's manifesting your Italian abilities. Capisci? That's what it is. Very simple. Manifesting means making manifest what's so. In an analogous way, this is just analogous because the problem is with the example. It's a seed makes manifest its tomato-ness, its oakness, when it bursts forth with a shoots and a plant and fruit. But if we think, if we get caught in, oh, that's a seed, but that's not yet a tomato, then we're getting caught in the analogy. So don't get caught. But manifest means someone hands you tea, put your hands out and take it. Take the cup. That's manifesting your nature.
And that's it sounds like harmony that we use.
That's a different word, and it's a different thing. Manifesting, harmony is different than manifesting. Manifest means to make real, visible, evident what's so. Let's use that word. Okay, but we can, enough of it. Just be present. There's one and two here.
It is difficult to sit with, be with, I am evil people that I face.
Wait, evil?
Evil.
See, when we to have the story that they're evil, that they're evil people.
There are evil people.
There are people who do things. See, that's in part, we talked about it yesterday. Part of this is this absolute equality is dependent on our being, not being fixed, separate, permanent, but being a product of the ongoing cause and effect of that our life is, means that, yes, there are people who do harmful things. Even we. And we can keep doing harmful things. And there are consequences of that. But how do we be in the world where, as a result of the cause and effect, this person is doing harmful things to me? You could call him an evil person who's doing evil things to me or to others. So maybe manifesting Buddha nature is to arrest him and put him in prison, or her in prison, or something else. Yes, I agree 100%. As a result of the absolute interpenetration of things, all sorts of events are possible because of our unfixedness, because of the fact that there isn't mere coincidence, but cause and effect results in all sorts of behavior, harmful behavior, self-centered behavior, vicious behavior, if I use that kind of word. Yes. That's right. And how do we respond to that in a skillful way? A skillful means appropriate for what's happening and what's called for and what's needed. Yes. Now, I'm not being Pollyannish about things. Just because it's an absolute oneness, if I use that kind of word, doesn't mean that the differences are vitiated or there isn't something that needs to be done about the differences. No, just the opposite. Because of the absolute oneness means that you will have to take care of the cause and effect that results in whatever's happening here. And the interrelationship and interdependence of that calls for us to do something. Yes. And what to do depends on the situation, your abilities, your capacities, where you are and who you are. If you're the general of an army, it's very different than if you're here in Champaign in a room talking. You have different capacities and different things that you can do and you need to do or don't need to do. If you're the governor of a state, you have responsibilities that are very different than the responsibilities of the teacher in a classroom. The governor of this state has to deal with terrible financial mess and all sorts of corruption and abuses of office by various administrators. I don't have to deal with that. I couldn't deal with it because I have no capacity to do anything. But that, whoever's the governor, has to deal with that. Because that's his, in this case, his responsibility to deal with it. Just like the, you know, prosecuting attorney needs to deal with people who've committed crimes and need to be brought to court and prosecuted. That's the capacity. Yes. That's the cause and effect complete openness, if I use that kind of word, complete unfixedness, which allows us to do what's called for in the situation. If I'm here and this tea spills all over, I might have to grab my papers and use them to blot the tea up, despite the fact that my papers get ruined. Or I might have to grab my clothes and you know, do that. Because that's what's called for. Or maybe not. That has to do with the non-fixedness. That has to do with the non-separation. Because things aren't fixed and are not separate. And we can see some relationship and some things we can't see. So, for instance, we could look up in the sky and see our own face in all the stars, and then all of a sudden there's an asteroid that's been traveling for hundreds of thousands of years, let us say, and we discover that it's on its way to hit Earth. And in a little while, as a result of all sorts of causes, most of which we can't see until we start seeing it coming here, it's going to hit Earth and do all sorts of major damage to all the life that's here. I'm not saying that that's happening, please don't. But if that has happened, at least according to some theories, I don't know enough, but my scientific understanding is that that happened. And it resulted in millions of deaths and major disruption and explosions. All sorts of cause and effect. We might even struggle if that was, we thought that was happening, to try to figure out what we could do about it. Whether we could or couldn't, who knows? Anyway, so did that get a little bit to your question? See, but we, what's good for us, you're welcome, is to see it on an immediate personal, not an abstract general, but in the immediate personal responding to people close and a little distant who do things that we react to, and what's skillful and appropriate in both recognizing our unity and our differences with them and responding in that way, as opposed to getting stuck in one side or the other. Oh, it's okay if they beat me up, after all we're all one. Or I hate them, they're a son of a bitch and I need to shoot them because they shoplifted that thing, after all we're two, and you know their life isn't worth anything because they shoplifted. So how, what's an appropriate and skillful reaction, response? Not getting stuck in habits. Not simple. And things escalate. And then we get more and more entangled.
I want you to say a little more about the difference between intrinsic and experiential. I guess I don't understand the intrinsic. What that means.
I intrinsically can lift 50 pounds, but until I make the effort and lift it, I don't experience the lifting of 50 pounds, even though I intrinsically, because I have these muscles and these nerves, intrinsically you can say to someone, yes, you can
are you talking about capacity?
It's more than capacity. It's what's so, but what's so without you really knowing it, except in your head, except as word, except conceptually. You don't know it in your own life. Your life experience.
So
in a way, practice is being experiencing. Just because you know something doesn't mean it's so for you. Until you experience it, it doesn't become a basis for your functioning. You might know that it's cold outside. Well, let me think about this for a moment. You might know that it's cold outside, but you're not going to shiver till you step out without a coat and without a hat, and the wind blows and you and you experientially know how cold it is, despite the fact that someone told you it's 10 degrees out there and a wind chill factor of 15 below. But when you go out there, you know it for yourself. No one could convince you, oh, it's not a big deal out there. You know, they just say it's that. It's really wrong. They've got the thermometer set wrong and they don't know. But they can't convince you once you've stepped out there and stood there for a little bit.
Intrinsic is a concept.
Intrinsic means that it's so, but it doesn't function as so. Because it's not, if I use the word activated. See, we're talking about, here I'm using, talking about a condition outside, but intrinsic means intrinsically who you are. So, for instance, I could say to you, oh yeah, you'll float. That's not, let me see. Or I could say to you, you're capable of floating. And you could say, yeah, I'm capable of floating in water. I know it, but I've never been in water. So, but I believe it. I'm capable of... Once you lie down in water and float in it, then you know for yourself the experience of floating, and you know for yourself that you float in water. I'm just using that as an analogy. So it's not something that's just conceptual. It's more than that. The intrinsic aspect is more than just the conceptual or words and or theoretical, but it's in terms of your own, you know, what's so.
But if you know that you know that it's possible to float in water, is you know that as a concept.
Yes.
And once you get in the water and you actually float, that then you know
that you
float in a different way.
Right. And that's right. You do know it in a different way. But I don't want to... The concept word is good, but it's not quite enough. The intrinsic means it's not something added on. It's not something that you need to learn anew. It's what's so, but what hasn't been so for you until you actually sense it for yourself. Many times used the example of Anyadatta, which is a traditional Indian story about Buddha nature. Some of you have heard it. Someone one day woke up and was convinced he had lost his head. And he went around and told his friends he was looking for his head, and his friends laughed at him. And he started bugging them all, telling them, I've lost my head, please help me find my head. And they tell him, you have your head. No, 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 I don't have my head. I'm convinced, I'm sure, I don't have my head, I've lost it, I've got to go find it. And, you know, no matter what they said to him, he couldn't be convinced. Some of them tied him up so that he couldn't run around and bug them anymore. They just got sick of him. Still wasn't convinced. Till one person came up to him and slapped his face real hard. And he went, oh, my head! I've got my head! Isn't it wonderful? I've got my head! And then after they untied him, he went around and bothered them all. Isn't it wonderful? I got my head! Ain't that great? I've got my head! And they said, stop it, of course. No, no, you got to... Okay, so Anyadatta, this is an example of, if I use the word, Buddha nature or true nature. We go around and are convinced of our separate self-centeredness. And we convince everyone else and say we're looking for something to take care of this problem that's caused by self-centeredness, by greed, anger, and ignorance, if I use that kind of word. And they say, you know, no, everyone's Buddha nature. And they say, no, no, it's not so. He says, no, it's not so. All the sutras say, no, no, it's not so. Till you're forced to do zazen, sit still, be present, and at some point, circumstance, I don't mean a slap across your head, but circumstance of a moment allows you to awaken that, oh, I've got my head. I've always had my head. Isn't that great? So this is just an analogy. But I don't remember why I even brought this up. But anyway.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Okay, thank you all.
Copyright Elihu Genmyo Smith.